The Month in Review. It seems as though we've had every kind of weather this month, from warm beach days to hard frost, gloomy fog to that wild coastal windstorm. We've seen all kinds of news headlines as well. Some, like the closure of the Journal Tribune newspaper, fall into a pattern of similar headlines we've been reading over the years. Others, like the new federal guidelines for hemp farmers, presage a new chapter in Maine's story. A wheelchair athlete competed in a high school cross-country meet after challenging the Maine Principals Association, and local political races heated up in Portland, Bangor, and other towns. I'm Jennifer Rooks. As you look back on the month of October, which stories mattered most to you? Join our conversation with three Maine editorial page editors next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. From the power outages a couple weeks ago to the ongoing impeachment inquiry, it has been quite a month. Today, we're going to talk about the news of October. Joining me in the studio, Greg Kessich, who is editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Thank you all, as always, for joining us today. And as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What mattered most to you this month? Is there a story that you've been thinking about that maybe didn't get a lot of attention? If so, give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Ben Bragdon, let's start with what's going on right now in Washington and as it relates in Maine. We're waiting right now to find out what is exactly in the resolution from Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. But as we're waiting for this, and we know that there's going to be a vote tomorrow in the House of Representatives, we haven't heard much from either Shelley Pingree or Jared Golden. Why not? And I should note that we're having this conversation at 1:07 on Wednesday, and fully aware this program rebroadcasts at 8 o'clock. We may have some answers by then.
News moves fast. Yes, we haven't heard either from either of them yet. I haven't heard a whole lot nationally either about people coming down, you know, saying for certain. I think the attention's been on the specifics in the resolution that would formalize the impeachment inquiry. But obviously a big decision for Jared Golden. He represents the second district, which gave Donald Trump a 10% win just 3 years ago. There isn't much of indication that that's changed. The resolution is kind of worded in a way that it's just kind of lays out the ground rules for the impeachment inquiry. It doesn't make any conclusions about it. So maybe that would give Jared Golden a little cover. But we've also seen from the Maine Republican Party and from the National Party already setting up if Golden votes in favor of this resolution, of attacking him from the right, saying this is not what your second district constituents want, and that trying to, you know, cleave him from some of the voters that gave him a win just last year.
All right. And Susan, this is the Bangor Daily News, neck of the woods. What are you hearing from readers about Jared Golden?
Well, about Jared Golden and the impeachment proceedings, I mean, they're very conflicted. You know, Democrats, of course, think that President Trump should be impeached, so they want to hear from Jared that that's what he's going to vote for. But there are obviously still a lot of supporters of the president who believe that, you know, this is a witch hunt, to use the common terminology. And, you know, they're ready to pounce on Jared if he does vote to proceed with the impeachment proceedings. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Greg?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's important to remember that Jared Golden didn't run for office because he wanted to impeach Donald Trump. He has a pretty aggressive agenda in terms of things like prescription drug. You know, I forget. He's going to do something with prescription drugs, make them more affordability, and you know, and things like that. Working on healthcare, other issues. He's tried to, you know, kind of distance himself from the ongoing inquiry and sort of parsing his words very carefully. But if the reports that I've seen so far that describe this this vote as a, just a you know, a referendum on whether or not the process or how the process should go forward and what the role of the minority party will be and who can ask questions and things like that, I can't believe that there would be much of a reason to vote against it, given how much evidence of wrongdoing has already come out, just in terms of the public statements that were the opening statements of several of the witnesses, Ambassador Taylor last week, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of the lieutenant colonel from the security. I can tell you a lot about him, but I can't remember his name. Make it pretty clear that there's something that needs to be investigated in terms of whether or not the president abused his power in order to get political favors out of a strategic ally and used appropriated U.S. dollars to as leverage.
And although she hasn't said so publicly, everybody is assuming pretty much that Shelley Pingree will vote yes tomorrow, yeah, yeah. as she supported everything so far.
Right. She was an early supporter of the impeachment inquiry, you know, right from the start.
Susan Young, we have an election next Tuesday. Many people in Maine will vote on two questions on their ballot. I was thinking as I drove around the state recently, it is sort of a tale of two states right now, whether or not there is a local municipal election. Some communities like Portland and Augusta are just full of campaign signs, and then others are empty. What are you watching?
Well, the Bangor City Council election is really interesting. They have the most candidates ever, or at least as far back as city records go. They have 11 candidates running for four seats, and just a real diversity of candidates in age, in their background. So we're pretty energized to see so much interest. Oftentimes, you know, you have maybe one more person than open seats, or sometimes none at all, and everyone that gets a vote is going to be elected or reelected. So it's interesting to see so many people at a time when we hear politics are so nasty and folks don't want to participate, seeing people throw their hat into the ring. Also, we have two statewide issues that a lot of people have forgotten about. So it is important to get out Tuesday. We have a transportation bond, $105 million to be matched with a lot of federal and other funding. Obviously, road, bridge repair, other infrastructure work very desperately needed in the state, and a constitutional amendment to make sure that folks with disabilities can fully participate in our democracy by being able to sign citizen initiative petitions. That does require a change in the state constitution, which makes it seem like, you know, really weighty question, but it will ensure that folks who are physically able to sign their names can still have a role to play in deciding whether citizen initiative petitions move forward. So it's an important change that we believe people should support.
Susan, I want to go back to the Bangor City Council race. Why do you think there are so many candidates? Is there one particular issue or is there something else going on?
I think there's just a lot of interest. I had an interesting conversation with Rob Glover, who's a political science professor at the University of Maine, and he saw from 2016, 2018, just a lot more people engaged in politics, whether that means going to events and rallies, donating money, and running for office. Certainly there's groups like Emerge Maine and She Leads that are focused more on recruiting women candidates of particular political persuasions. But those groups have been really active in getting a lot more women to run for office. And it's interesting looking at the candidate profiles. They do have a diversity of issues that they feel are most important. Several candidates focusing on public transportation needs in the Bangor region. Taxes are always an important issue. The quality of education. So in addition to their broad backgrounds, it's interesting to see what issues they're focusing on as well.
And Greg, I'm going to turn to you for the Portland mayor's race. What is notable to you about the race this time around?
Well, about 9 years ago, Portland changed its charter to have a popularly elected mayor. Before, the mayor had been a kind of a super city councilor, chosen by the rest of the city council. And this is our third time around, and every time it seems that the race is almost always about what the Portland mayor is rather than who it should be. There's always a debate about what the right proper role for the office is, because it's still not very well defined. It's an unusual setup where the mayor is a full-time elected official who has an office in City Hall, but has no power to hire and fire, and all employees are under the city manager, and the council hires and fires the city manager. So the mayor has to be able to work with the council to have any kind of leverage over, big picture things that the city is doing. And so far, that hasn't worked out so well in the two first mayoral candidates. So we have Ethan Strimling, who is the current mayor of Portland, is kind of a polarizing figure, like we see in a lot of areas of politics these days. And this time around, he is focused on social issues and progressive politics in a way that saying that his candidacy is really about moving things forward, like $15 minimum wage or
no plastic straws.
No, but that seems to be they all came to agreement on that. No plastic straws, which really upsets some people. I don't understand that. I get a lot of letters to the editor about people who are really, really mad about no plastic straws. So, they're raising a ton of money, both. The leading contender, Spencer Thibodeau, who was a member of the city council, and Ethan Strimling have both raised over $100,000. There is a pack on sort of an anti-Strimling pack. It's not really acquainted with any particular candidate, but it's pretty much clearly against him. It's called Unite Portland. They're running into some issues with state ethics department about whether they've filed their forms in time. They're a new group, one of the Spencer Thibodeau is planning on spending a lot of money on television ads, which is really new in local politics in Portland. Who knows? Maybe there. We'll see if it works. But he's buying time on the evening news shows, which, from my understanding, is don't have the audience that they used to have.
Yeah, Ben. What about other towns? Are you watching anything that is interesting to you? Augusta, Waterville, somewhere else?
We have a number of council races going on in Central Maine. We have an Augusta city council race and one in Waterville and one in Hollowell, among others. Nothing huge, but these races, I kind of echo what Susan was saying, full of good candidates who have a long history of public service in a number of different ways. They've worked with local organizations, they've headed them up, they've done economic development, they've done service and nonprofit work. It takes a lot to run, even a medium-sized city like Waterville or Augusta. These really small main towns, the elected officials really do a lot of heavy lifting, but even in the medium-sized towns, they do a lot. And it's great to see such a good pick, a wide variety of candidates in these city council races. I don't know how much attention they're getting, because an off year without much on the ballot, it's kind of hard to get people out to the polls. But I've gotten a lot of letters on that Augusta city council race, and I think it's going to be a pretty interesting one.
All right. And I want to quickly, Susan, circle back to what you're talking about, the constitutional amendment that would make, certain disabled voters able to vote more easily. Mal Leary, I was chatting with him this morning, our senior political reporter, and he is sort of surprised that there has been no campaign to show just what this race means. We're not seeing ads about it. We're not seeing any kind of outreach, or at least broadly. And I'm wondering if you agree, and if you think this may be affect this vote on Tuesday.
Yeah, just to clarify, it's not about voting. It's about petition signatures. The Constitution requires that someone actually sign their signature in order for it to be a valid support for moving a citizen petition onto the ballot. But there are some folks, you know, who may be paralyzed or who have had amputations that cannot physically sign their name. So this would allow them to use a stamp or, I believe, designate someone else to be their signer. But it is very interesting that there has not been a campaign. I don't know why, but disability groups typically support these things. I mean, they may have decided that there are a lot of other areas where their money would be better spent to advocate for other changes. But it is a concern that folks are not going to understand the question or see that it's a constitutional amendment. And for a lot of people, they think, oh, that's a really big deal. I don't know that I support that because I don't really like changing the Constitution without a really big reason. So it's a concern that people don't fully understand what this question is about and what it would do.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I didn't even know this was on the ballot until I wrote about it last week, to be honest with you. I came across it when I was looking at other election stuff, and I said, geez, we've got a question, too, we should look into. And this came kind of out of my neck of the woods. It was from Representative Bruce White, who's a Democrat from Waterville, who went to the Secretary of State's office, and he wanted to do something. You know, Maine's known for having very low barriers to get participate in elections, and he was asking, you know, what can we do to improve on that? And this was one of the suggestions. It's in a state like that values this, it's surprising it hasn't come up before. Some of the disabilities groups say that they haven't seen it, you know, affect an individual yet, but it certainly could. You know, maybe it's just a case that there's not a whole lot of bandwidth, you know, from the time when this bill comes up in the legislature, it's kind of overshadowed by a million other things. And then by the time it comes to now, there's just, you know, there's not one big group that's kind of carried this through and has to push it through to Election Day. But it's a little strange that with nothing else going on, we haven't heard about it.
Well, we have so much more to talk about, including the big power outage after the big nor'easter, the lobster plan from DMR, the closure of the Journal Tribune newspaper, but we do need to go to a break. If you'd like to join this conversation, and we would love for you to join this conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Looking back at the month in October, we'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And Central Maine Healthcare's Topsom Care Center, bringing specialty care, imaging, lab services, and more to one convenient location at the Topsom Fair Mall.
Hunter Biden's work with the Ukrainian energy company is part of a long history of the relatives of famous politicians seeking to cash in on connections.
Very often there's nothing wrong. Nothing is actually done that's illegal, but that's different than does it become a scandal. It looks bad.
Money, family, and politics this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be Sam Esmail, creator, writer, and director of the TV series Mr. Robot, starring Rami Malek as a hacker with dissociative identity disorder. His attempts to save the world are at risk of destroying it. The fourth and final season is underway on the USA Network. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the news that made headlines in October. My guests, three editorial page editors, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org.
tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. So much more to talk about. But during the break, we were talking about the story of the wheelchair athlete who had to bend fight to race cross country.
Yes.
State championships coming up November 2nd, and he will
race. Yes. Well, Jonathan Showmaker, he's a sophomore at Leavitt Area High School. He's got a neurological disorder that affects his motor skills, and he's in a wheelchair. And for the last two regular seasons, he's raced along with his teammates on the cross-country team, along with the other competitors on the same course, sometimes, you know, slightly modified for his wheelchair. He has his dad come with him and help him make sure he doesn't go backwards too much. He's got kind of a big, almost a mountain bike type wheelchair. And, you know, it's never been a problem in these races. And I guess dating back all the way to his middle school, it's been a long time he's been running alongside the other racers. Last year, the Maine Principals Association, which governs the regionals and the state championships, said he couldn't race in the regionals. And he did not race last year. And he appealed that. And for this year, after he had ran, competed successfully in all the regular season races, the MPA rejected his appeal and said he couldn't race in the regional, which was scheduled for last weekend. It seemed like a really, you know, curious decision, given that you know, that he had raced without any problems throughout the season. They were worried about how he would interact with the other runners, and it had never been a problem before. And where there were minor problems, the teams had come together and solved them. And it kind of seemed like, you know, this is what high school sports is all about. And the MPA is it seems like it should be a champion of that. But they said no. There was a big uproar. Should give some credit to Adam Robinson at the Sun Journal, who was covering the story almost on a daily basis for the last month. After this big uproar, the MPA came back and said, well, maybe we can have you run a separate race on a separate course on the same day, or maybe we'll do another race with everybody that doesn't count. And I should say that his scoring does not count towards his team's scoring. So this isn't a fairness issue or anything like that. It's more that he just wants to race at the same time, be treated as the same as the other athletes. The MPA came up with this kind of what they saw as a compromise. It was not acceptable to most people, and finally they allowed him to run last weekend. And last Saturday they held the regionals, and lo and behold, there were no problems. He got a huge cheer, and it seemed like a really great day for high school sports. And it's just kind of baffling that the MPA took that long to come around to what everybody thought was the right decision.
Greg, am I imagining things, or am I having flashbacks to girls being allowed to wrestle?
Sure. No, it's every time there's an inclusion of a group that hasn't been included before, you hear the same kind of objections, and it's reflected in a really cautious attitude by some of the regulatory bodies. But these issues never seem to appear. That everybody's better off if you include everybody. And this is not, like Ben said, you know, why we have high school sports. It's not a pre-professional running program. It's about expressing yourself and challenging yourself and working harder and being part of a team. And people with disabilities benefit from that just as much as anybody else, and there's really no reason to exclude them. So it's nice that it had a happy ending.
Susan, before we move on to other topics, anything to add on this one?
Well, hopefully it opens the door to other competitors who, you know, rightly so, believe they couldn't participate in cross country. So hopefully, you know, down the road at some point, we'll see wheelchair divisions, you know, in high school cross country, as well as more athletes come forward to participate.
All right. Well, I'm going to move on to another topic, and
using two emails that have come in already. These are both about the Biddeford Journal Tribune, or I guess more recently called the Journal Tribune newspaper, which closed this past month. One person is talking about its owner, says the former owner, the chief reason the Journal Tribune is now defunct was the leadership of Ed Pierce. He thought he was being a smart businessman to cut the paper down from 20 pages to 6. It was a disaster. He did the same thing to the New Hampshire Laconia paper that closed a few years ago under his leadership. Sorry to say 100 plus years of journalistic history was ended. And it was 135 years. And here's an email from Chad. People who are complaining about newspapers like the Journal Tribune folding were asked if they themselves subscribed to the paper, and they said no. Right. Greg Kesich.
Yeah, I think those two, that last letter really capsulizes it. If it was just one bad executive, newspapers wouldn't be closing all over the country. We're in the middle of a this information revolution in terms of how people get their news and how people get information in addition to news. And we've completely expanded the ability to get information, but we haven't expanded like our attention spans. You know, we only can take in so much. And a paper like the Journal Tribune is not competing against like a local weekly or a radio station that had that used to have local news on it. They're competing against the New York Times and the Washington Post and, professional wrestling and everything you can possibly imagine. So, you know, that's what's going on. And the reason the paper shrunk was not because an executive thought it was a good idea to have a smaller paper. It shrunk because advertising revenue is declining and readership and advertising revenues are both declining at a similar pace. And it's really too bad. I understand it's a for-profit business, and we're in a very difficult market, and it's up to us to kind of come up with new ways to engage with customers. But I think a city like Biddeford, which is going through a lot right now, it's going through a real rebirth. There is a lot of very important public issues that are being debated. And to not have a daily newspaper with a reporter assigned to cover those city council meetings and planning board meetings, people are gonna lose out. And if they have to depend on self-interested observers who publish their thoughts on social media, to promote a particular cause, they're not going to get the information that they need.
All right, Susan Young.
Studies have shown that in communities where they lose a local newspaper, as Greg said, there's a lot of issues that don't get covered anymore. Taxes tend to go up. There's more government malfeasance and corruption just because you don't have journalists paying attention to what's going on. So, as he said, people need to really understand the value of local journalism and that it's not done by somebody else when those media outlets close. And so the message is, if people value their local news, they need to subscribe to their local paper, whether it's online or in print. And we need to have a source of revenue so we can continue to pay the salaries of the reporters, photographers, and editors that work at those papers so they can keep the community informed.
All right. Well, this says it leaves 6 daily newspapers in Maine. Although you and Ben, you and Greg work for different papers, same ownership.
Right.
And I'm going to take a moment here to have you all explain what that means from your perspective. I know that there's some sharing of stories. Do you still operate as independent papers with independent editorial decision?
Yes, largely. Each of the papers, the Morning Sentinel and the Kennebec Journal, where I work, have had a long-standing relationship with the Portland Press Herald. We were already one editorial board when I came on board, so we've always been working together. And then the two newsrooms or three newsrooms have really always shared stories and shared coverage. That's changed. I mean, there's been times where the Kennebec Journal was, had a statehouse reporter and they were competing against the Press Herald. But as the economics have changed, then that's kind of changed, and we've tried to coordinate to make sure that our resources go as far as they can, with all these newspapers now falling under the Maine Today umbrella, I guess, or the
masthead.
Masthead, yes. masthead umbrella. It's more of that has happened. We have the Sun Journal now. We have all these weeklies. There is, effort to make sure that people aren't, there isn't a ton of overlap. There is still, and sometimes that's good, but there's also, trying to get share stories so we can get each paper can give readers the best stuff that they have. So, we're all on one system now, one computer back end system, so we can really share things very quickly, and there's a lot of coordination among all the editors.
And, I want to mention that, six daily newspapers in Maine seems to so many people like such a small number compared to how it used to be. But the reality is, and the sad reality is, for a state of 1.2 million people, compared to the rest of the country, that's a lot.
Yeah, and Maine's been pretty lucky. You can look at areas of this country where journalism has just been decimated. And where there's no one watching anymore, or a big hedge fund company has come in and bought a property and gutted it and made as much money out of it as they could while killing the newspaper and then moved on, and that's happened everywhere and has not happened in Maine yet. We have until the Journal Tribune closed, we hadn't had a daily paper close, when I look around to other parts of the country at local journalism, it's just about as strong in Maine as it is anywhere, and then you can debate about whether that's good or not. But Maine's still pretty holding out with its local newspapers.
We have cities in America with population similar to the state of Maine that have one newspaper. Yeah. Lewiston and Bangor and Portland and Augusta and Waterville, competing is a pretty rich environment.
We'll go to Nicole, who's calling from Bowdoin. Hi, Nicole, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the issue of gun deaths in Maine. We have somebody dies from guns, a gunshot every other day, almost every other day, and still our legislature has not done anything substantive to address this. There was a bill last year, last legislative season, the Red Flag Bill, which would have addressed in particular the issue of suicide, which 88% of our gun deaths in Maine are suicides. And also would have helped in the case of domestic violence. And that's pretty much the sum total of the gun deaths that we're seeing.
Sure, sure, Nicole.
So it's very disappointing.
I appreciate you calling. We are doing a month in review, and this hasn't been before the legislature this month in October. But we did do a Maine calling program on this one, and it's really interesting because where people fall, whether for or against the red flag law, is not necessarily the usual suspects. NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, is opposed to the red flag law. Ben?
Yeah. One way to make this current is that, the Legislative Council just decided which bills it's going to look at next session in the so-called emergency session. And they denied, I think, all the gun-related bills. They're just not going to go there. I don't know. I mean, I can draw some of this back, I think, to the background check referendum we had a few years ago. That was a big push on an issue that gun control activists thought that they could get some traction on in this state. And it was a tough campaign, a divisive campaign, and it ultimately failed. And since then, I think a lot of Democrats, Janet Mills among them, have kind of looked at that and said, maybe guns is not where I want to spend my political capital. It's upsetting to a wide swath of the state. We do have a very safe state. Like Nicole said, though, a lot of the gun violence in this state is suicides, which has a big thing to do with gun availability. Domestic violence, which, the gun never has to be fired a lot of times for it to cause a problem in those situations. And that's kind of the tack that gun gun control activists have taken, this isn't about hunting. This isn't about your hunting rifle or about mass shootings or about crime, street crime as we would see it in some of the bigger cities, but about suicide and domestic violence and just general gun safety. But it hasn't really picked up in the legislature. And there's a wide swath, I think, of Democratic legislators who just don't want to get anywhere near it.
Susan, anything to say?
Well, to Nicole's point, as Ben said, we are a very safe state, and the crime statistics just came out last week, and overall crime is down. But we still have the pervasive problem of domestic violence, and typically each year about half of the state's homicides are domestic violence related, and that was true a little less than half this year. But a majority of those deaths did involve firearms, and sadly all of the victims are women. So clearly a lot of work remains to be done on the domestic violence front. As Ben said, there's a lot of people who are affected beyond those who are killed, and the presence of a gun in a home puts women at much greater risk of violence and of murder. So it's unfortunate that the Legislative Council did not want to look at any of those bills that were proposed. But clearly, it's a conversation that we need to have, and we need to find a way to bridge the concerns both of those who strongly support the Second Amendment, but also public safety advocates who want to make sure that the notion of Maine being a very low crime state extends to everyone in the state, including the women who live here.
Nicole, thank you so much for your call. We are going to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Woodsford's Family Services, reminding you that you can make a difference in the life of a Maine child today by becoming a foster parent. Woodsfords.org. An engine presenting the second annual York County Mini Maker Fair this Sunday. Details at yorkcounty.makerfair.com. This afternoon at 2 o'clock, Maine Public Radio will broadcast New Hampshire Public Radio's program, The Exchange, featuring a conversation with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination. Be sure to tune in at 2 o'clock today on Maine Public Radio.
Hunter Biden's work with a Ukrainian energy company is part of a long history of the relatives of famous politicians seeking to cash in on connections.
Very often there's nothing wrong. Nothing is actually done that's illegal. But that's different than does it become a scandal? It looks bad.
Money, family, and politics this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Month in Review, my guest Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. We'd love to have you join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. What have you been watching or thinking about this month in the news in Maine? Here's an email from ER. The recent power outage and the criticism of power companies. Seth Barry is proposing a change in CMP. Many hate the company from its proposed corridor and its billing problems. Following the disasters from PG&E in California, particularly, it is prioritizing its shareholders over the public in terms of line and tree maintenance. That's a lot. but, it's true. We had a big storm and a lot of outages. I was one of them. I'm sure you all were too, Greg.
Very briefly, but I was out for a little while. The federal energy regulators rate every different market in the country about how long they have their power is out, the typical customer, and you know, how often their power is out and how long they're out. And Maine and CMP's territory is always like right up at the top of the list of having the longest outages. And it has a lot to do with the number of trees that we have. I live in Portland. I don't really lose power very often because I live in an area without very many trees. But most of the state is in a different situation. But there is, you know, a lot of people angry at CMP. And you know, she listed off a few of the hot button issues, the billing controversy, and the corridor to bring the Hydro-Quebec power into New England. But yes, there is a bill to that was held over from last session that would create a study to look at making a consumer-owned cooperative electricity entity for the state. And certainly stories like this don't hurt that effort at all. That's going to be something that will be up on the, up for discussion in January.
It was an impressive sight to see all the trucks from all over places like New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, as well as southern New England, come in to help bring the power back. Ben, did CMP improve its reputation at all with its response to this storm?
I don't know. It felt a little weird to have such a long power outage in the fall and not have it accompanied by snow, I guess. I don't know. My power was out for about 12 hours, and I was gone most of the time, and it was still like, it was like Lord of the Flies by the end of it. So I don't know how willing people are to deal with even a short power outage.
I had 3 days.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. I didn't deal with that. But, CMP has a plan for cutting down a lot of these trees. They want to go a little further out of the right-of-way to do it. They've put this before the state regulators. It's going to cost a lot of money, and they haven't decided how to pay for that yet, but it's eventually going to come back to ratepayers. So they're going to have to make the argument that if you want more reliability, then you're going to have to pay more money. And I don't know if people are willing to take that argument from them right now. That may be difficult.
There really is a cultural impact, though, that maybe isn't even accounted for sometimes. I'm thinking about a local business near where I lived. A small store told me they lost $25,000 worth of inventory. I know the University of Southern Maine closed a dorm, a big dorm, and kicked kids out and canceled Parents Weekend. Just a couple of the things that happened that have real impacts on people's lives. I mean,
I mean, it wasn't that long ago that people just didn't have electricity.
That is,
but now that we have it, it is, you don't want to go an hour without it. You know, once your phone gets down to under 20% and the battery turns green, I think people get really nervous about not having electricity. No, it's wide ranging, and you're right. I mean, I lost some stuff out of my fridge. I didn't even think about businesses that have it and if they don't have backup and what they lose, for businesses that are just barely making it by, I'm sure that can have a big effect.
Susan, not so bad up there, right?
True, but still a lot of outages in the Amira area, but I think they were not nearly as long and not as many of them as in southern Maine, just because the winds and the weather were not quite as bad here. I was actually flying out on Thursday morning on one of those little jets, so that was not the most fun trip ever. And CMP also did not do itself any favors when it has, on its website, when outages will be resolved, and it said something like 2068. Yeah. So of course a lot of people, fixated on that and said, see, this company can't do anything right. They can't even get their power restoration date right. I mean, the hard thing is we don't know if these power companies are owned by their customers or owned by different entities. Would the situation be different? That's just hard to know. As Greg pointed out, we have a lot of trees and people love having their tree-lined streets. And when CMP wants to cut down trees, sometimes there's protests and people don't want that to happen. So, you know, it's hard to suss out what's really the problem here. Is it that we have big corporations that don't care, or is it that we live in a place where, you know, things aren't necessarily aligned to ensure that our electricity is always on? But certainly, to your point, Jennifer, we tend to forget the impacts on businesses. And when businesses don't have electricity for a really long time, I mean, it's costly and it's a real problem for them. So certainly, whoever owns our state's utilities, we're going to need to do a lot to improve reliability, especially at the local level.
And sure, and this is maybe not at the end of this hour the time to start the conversation about whether more power lines ought to be buried. But Susan, I want to turn to you because we haven't talked about lobsters yet. A couple bits of news coming about lobsters in Maine. One, a couple different studies building on what scientists already suspect, that we may have reached our peak of lobsters and that the population may be returning to historic levels in the near future. Of course, there's a lot of ifs and maybes in these studies. But then also recently, just very recently, DMR came up with its new regulations. And from what I understand, they don't look that different than the old ones.
Yeah, first of all, on the lobster stocks, we have reports from lobstermen and others that the catch this year is way down from years past. The question, of course, is does that mean that the scientists are right, that the lobster boom is past? It appears that the season may be moving to later in the year. Lobstermen report the spring. They were seeing a lot of what they call sublegal lobsters. They're too small to catch, so they're hoping that those guys are growing and that when they go back in the fall, they're going to have a better catch. And that does seem to be the case, that lobstermen are catching more lobsters now and hope to continue to do so. Of course, the weather gets worse. It makes that an even harder job. So there's the question is, you know, with global climate change, is the timing of the season changing? Also, there were some issues with bait and the availability and cost of bait. So remains to be seen. But it is interesting that so far the catch appears to be down substantially from previous years. And as far as the rules, you know, I think there's some important differences from the federal regulations that the lobster industry in Maine, of course, did not like. I think better differentiating offshore and inshore, trying to address the issue of where the whales might be versus where they're not, and making sure you have more stringent regulations farther from shore where it's more likely that the lobsters are, some requirements for gear marking, because as the industry and others have pointed out, we don't have good data on where the right whales are off the coast of Maine, so and where they become entangled. So it would be good to know where the entanglements are happening and what kind of gear it is, whether it's crabbing, whether it's lobster, and what state it comes from. So the state has focused on improving gear marking, which was also part of the federal requirements as well. So I think the meetings start next week with the industry to see what the feedback is. I'm guessing that the state rules may be a little more popular, but certainly aren't going to be really popular with the industry.
I'm going to go to an email from Pam. I have found that the ad that has been running in the Sunday paper concerning a Maine constituent meeting up with Senator Collins and addressing questions to her, since she never hosts town meetings, another issue for a later date, has been fascinating. I have never seen this before, but boy, has it been effective in catching our attention. I'm wondering if the Press Herald editor has some thoughts.
Well, I'm always pro people buying full page ads, and you know, if any caller wants to get hooked up with an advertising representative, I can give you some numbers. No, it is very interesting. I mean, I think Ben and I were talking about this. He didn't attempt to like submit it as an op ed or a letter to the editor. He went right to buying this full page ad. That's very you know, dramatic, and that he has total editorial control over. Seems a little odd with all that's happening in the world that the thing that pushed him over the top is that he overheard her say to somebody else that she thought he was rude. You know, it seemed like maybe...
And he assumed she was talking about him, because I think she said a constituent was rude.
Yeah. And so we don't really know. You know, like, you know, we've heard like snippets of from both sides about what she said and what she really said. And I don't have a good understanding of what really happened. It sounds like you know, he sat down with her and tried to pose some perfectly legitimate questions for a constituent to ask an elected official, and maybe she felt uncomfortable in that circumstance. And but in terms of the phenomena of people buying full page ads, great.
I have a question from Cindy. Has any of the guests heard about how the new state law banning cell phone use while driving is going? Anything coming
in? I actually just talked to Commissioner Soshuk about that yesterday. And he said, you know, they don't really have data yet. Obviously, it's still pretty early. And they're really focusing on education efforts and making sure people understand, you know, what the law is and why. You know, I'll fess up from personal behavior being much better and more diligent myself. But I haven't seen any actual data at this point.
I have some anecdotal observations. I see a lot of people at stoplights with their heads facing straight down. So like the top of their head is facing forward, you know, and I'm pretty sure that they think they're complying with the law by keeping the phone low. And the other thing is I got a little mount for my phone that I can put it on my dashboard, and it's like 10 times more compelling than it ever was. You know, I'm constantly flashing lights at me. And,
yeah, you know, I'm so glad Cindy asked this question, though, because I do feel as though the day it happened, people suddenly changed their attitude and started taking things more seriously at all sorts of, you know, I heard people talking about it in the grocery store. I heard people talking about it over, you know, my young adults in my life talking about this. I mean, people paid attention. This is not a law that was under the radar, and I didn't intend the pun, but I'm proud of it. Go ahead, Ben.
No, I mean, they built these machines to grab our attention, and they do that. They do that very well, you know, whether it's just constant updating of content or just the way they look and feel. And that's really bad when you're driving. I've tried to put mine away. I drive a lot, and I have I don't know if you can admit to a crime on the air, but I've definitely before the law passed was definitely would pick my phone up at some times to check things, and find myself keeping it much longer than I should have. So I've tried to put it away. I think enforcement's going to be a big deal. You know, we have a lot of speeding, and speeding's against the law, and they do enforcement, but it doesn't change it much. On the interstate, there's barely any traffic enforcement at any time. They do it in these big groups and places. So, but hopefully, by passing the law, people will just get the idea that it's the wrong thing to do, and we'll follow it that way.
All right. Well, thanks. And I suspect if I had a Maine State Trooper here, he'd say, oh, there's more enforcement than you think. It's unmarked cars. That voice you just heard, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. And Greg Kessich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Thank you to all of you for being here today. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from George Thomas. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.